obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Thank you, Chris. Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And Connie and I both want to thank Chris and Beverly for being such great hosts, and thank the committee for inviting us to spend the weekend with you. It's just a huge treat for us and a real privilege, believe me. Anytime that I'm given the opportunity to share just a little bit about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me and done for us, we couldn't be more happy and more pleased. So thank you for allowing us to be here. We've already had a great time and got to visit with some old friends and make some new friends, and it's been a real treat. And you know, I have to correct something already, though, that's been done here. I guess it's my job, but it was mentioned that I'm from Nashville, Tennessee, when actually I'm from Brentwood, Tennessee. And I will tell you, that's not important to me, but the folks in Nashville want you to know I'm from Brentwood. They will be more comfortable with that. Let me tell you that on July the 1st of 1989 was my first day in a treatment facility. My sobriety date is June 30th, 1989. So yesterday was my 22nd birthday. And I thank you for celebrating that with me, but as we all know, that's the story of my surrender. But I was not surrendered on July the 1st of 1989. I will promise you that. Because I wasn't in a treatment facility because I had any desire to stop drinking at all. I'd not had some epiphany. I'd not decided that my life needed or that I wanted some moral uplift. I wasn't looking for some huge change in my life. I was simply fulfilling my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, for the conviction of my 6th DUI a year before. And we'd done a plea bargain in that, and they had given me, it really was a math issue for me. They'd given me 60 days in jail or 10 weekends in jail and 28 days in a residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. And I just, even my public school rudimentary Tennessee math skills came up with 60 versus 48 wherever I spent it. And so I chose the 48 days over the 60 days. I can tell you, on June the 29th of 1989, Connie and I went out with three other couples. Because just kind of a last hurrah before I was going to go away. I came in that evening. I mean, it's the most embarrassing thing I'll share with you from up here tonight, frankly. I came in that evening. I had my last drink from that day till this, which was an Amaretto on the rocks. I know. I'm appropriately ashamed. But at least you now know that I didn't know that was going to be my last drink when I took it, right? I mean, because that's just not the way I would have gone down. As I said, surrender did not look like Amaretta to me. If there'd been a little meeting and they said, Steve, we've been talking and you can have one more drink, what will it be? You know, Amaretta would not have made my top 10. And I got, so for the last 22 years, I've had to share with people that that's my last drink. I mean, a lot of folks by now have already unidentified with me as an alcoholic. Al-Anons giggle at me. In fact, I'll be honest with you that, and I guess it's a little revealing that I have to tell you that I'll be honest with you, but I am just the poster boy for middle-class alcoholism. And, you know, by July the 2nd of 1989, I was already lying to people in that treatment center about regaling them with the stories of my escapades and what I did. And I tell you what I've discovered in the time since then, and I believe it's true for me, and I believe it's true for you, that our book says that in working with others, we tell the new man exactly what happened to us. And I believe that the primary thing of value that I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous is the truth about me, whatever that truth is. And I know that my story will not resonate with everyone, but it's perhaps my story will resonate with someone, and perhaps each of us are called upon to share the truth about ourselves. And that means that I best not minimize anything that I did do, and I need not embellish anything that I did not do. So I'm stuck with amaretto. Now, that's not the only drink that I had. And on June the 30th, after that amaretto, I got up, and that was a Friday, and my wife Connie and I spent that day with our then 5-year-old daughter, Abby. And I'll just tell one more story that will reveal what a wild drunkalog I have. We spent that day at Chuck E. Cheese, and and I just have to say that if anybody here hasn't sobered up yet, don't spend your first day sober at Chuck E. Cheese, okay? I mean, it was a hellish day at Chuck E. Cheese. And, as you know, that's no place to shake it out, and it's loud, and they're short. They're just coming at you from every angle, and just as I'm gaining my emotional balance, there's a 6-foot mouse coming toward me, and I'm trying hard not to see the mouse. And I asked Connie, "Baby, do you see the mouse?" And you know, and she did. And July the 1st, which was a Saturday, my friend Ricky came by to pick me up to drive me off to this treatment facility. And Connie walked out the door with us as we were getting ready to leave, and amongst her last words to me were, "No matter what, baby, don't stop drinking." And see, Connie and I were I don't say we were drinking buddies, because usually when we drank, we got in a fight with each other, but we drank a lot together, and we did a lot of other things. But I will go on and share with you that after giving me that that command, that 10 days later, she stopped drinking. So her sobriety date is 10 days after mine as well, and her 22nd birthday is coming up. Now, let me clarify for you whether it should be important or not. That 10 days is real important to me. And because, you know, things go sideways at our house. You know, I just say, "Just wait 10 days, baby. This will clear up for you." And, I wish you could see what I can see from this spiritual mountaintop. I came home from a conference a few years ago on Sunday evening late. I'm getting into bed. She wakes up to greet me, and she says, "You didn't tell them that 10-day thing, did you?" And I said, "Oh, I got to, baby. They love it, you know." And she said, "I just hate that." And I said, I know, but in 10 days you won't. And now, let me tell you, and I don't say this... I say this whether Connie is with me or not, that most of that is true. But the fact is that she blew by me on the spiritual fast lane a long time ago. And the two of us couldn't be more grateful for the life that we have and the relationship that we have, that we know is a direct result of our physical sobriety and our emotional sobriety and our ongoing vigilant participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're so grateful for the life that we have today and the experience of that life. I've already told you that you've already gathered I'm not a tough guy, that this isn't going to be one of those stories that many of you and some of us have. It's got its own, it will have its own momentum, and we will get to it in a minute. But so the miracle to me of Alcoholics Anonymous isn't that the conditions of my life change. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is the experience of my life from the inside out. Conditions have changed. In fact, sometimes they change for the better, and sometimes they change for the worse in my sobriety. But it's that profound alteration in my reaction to life that is what I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the experience of my life from the inside out that is the true miracle. My buddy Ricky's driving me over there on July the 1st. I'll go on and tell you, by the way, I'm going to do what you asked me to do the best I can, tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today. I just don't promise to do it in any particular order. And my story's kind of like a Quentin Tarantino movie, that there's just no time and space continuum. And I'll tell a host of what are probably unrelated stories that I hope come together by the end of the hour. But Ricky's driving me over there, and he said, "Steve, what do you think this deal's going to be like, man?" He knew I didn't want to go. Ricky texted me yesterday. He's not in AA. He's just still one of my good friends. He lives in Atlanta now, and he texted me congratulating me on 22 years since that ride to that facility. And I said, "Ricky, I don't know what it's going to be like, man, but I said, I'll tell you one thing. You know, I'd seen some bad TV movies of the week about Alcoholics Anonymous and treatment. And I said, I'm not going to get in some little circle and go, 'I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic,' and whine about the most intimate details of my life." And it was about 3 weeks later that I was just telling people way more than they wanted to know about me. And I was making stuff up by now, because I tell you, that Amaretta story was getting me no street cred in the treatment center, you know? We were riding over there, and the truth is that I was, I had a host of emotions. I was angry that I had to go. I felt put upon. It felt unfair. I felt all those things, perhaps. You know, how could this happen to me? I'm not one of those guys. You know, just circumstances beyond my control. But, hey, I'm going to do better. Why am I having to do this thing? I was frightened. Just a host of emotions I'm not sure that I could label or put a name to. I got there, and immediately they gave me a test. Some of you had a version. It was a test. They called it an assessment, but it felt very much like a test to me. There were 30 questions. We have our own questions at NAA, but these 30 all started with the phrase, "Have you ever?" See, you're ahead of me already, but I mean, "Have you ever," they said, means even once, and even with a really good reason. And the questions were like, "Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking?" 30 "have you ever" questions, which, as you know, just have check yes or check no to what are clearly essay questions. These are questions that beg for an explanation. And you know, we're laughing here, and I hope we do, and I hope we have a good time tonight. But what I know you folks know is that the reason that I can laugh about that today is because it's from today's vantage point and from today's point of view. But that morning, I can promise you, there was nothing funny going on. And I'm looking at these questions, and I know that people are going to draw conclusions about me based on how I check this box. And I mean it when I say, how can they do that and not know the backstory? How can they do that and not understand? How can you say yes or no to these types of questions? There are good reasons. You know, back in the back of the book, there's the story Freedom from Bondage. And she describes rationalization as giving a socially acceptable explanation for socially unacceptable behavior. And in a very real sense, that's what I was needed to do and trying to do with those questions. And what I realized, I'd done a lot of that all of my life, trying to find an explanation that is acceptable for behavior that's clearly unacceptable. And often I was trying to provide that explanation to someone else. But toward the end, I'm trying to provide those explanations to me so I can live with me becoming the person that I was becoming, doing the things that I was doing. But that morning, I'm just agonizing over these particular questions. And so I had questions about the questions, you know. "Have you ever drank in the morning?" I said, "Well, what do you mean morning?" And I mean, I think this is a legitimate question, because I knew what they were trying to figure out. See, I know if I answer yes, they're going to think I'm that guy that's grabbing that half pint of brown whiskey off his nightstand to get his heart started in the morning. But see, what if I'm at last call at 2 a.m. somewhere? I mean, what if I'm just up late drinking? Does that make me a morning drinker? I mean, so that's why you need to give more than yes or no answers. I'm agonizing over this. Have you ever drank alone? Oh, yeah, you know, but they left. I mean, do they ever just leave on you? And I'll tell you the other thing. And the flip side of that about drinking alone is I'm sure that I'm not alone here. That how many of us had to drink to go drinking? You know? I mean, how many of us had to have a few drinks so I can show up ready to play? And when our book calls alcohol a social lubricant, in a very real sense, that's one of the ways it worked for me, particularly early on, is it allowed me to move easily amongst you, easily in the world, rather than feeling like the ball in the pinball machine. You know, a few drinks and okay, I'm in. So the deal was, I think if you answered yes to three or four of these questions, you're a problem drinker, five, you're alcoholic, six, you're chronic alcoholic. I didn't know what chronic meant, but it seemed like a promotion from regular alcoholic. Now here's what I know, and what the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous shared with me very soon as we began to go out to meetings, is the way I answered the questions on that test is not what makes me alcoholic. I understand that's not the litmus test for my alcoholism. Those are the types of questions that might expose my alcoholism. It might shine a light on it. It might be evidence of alcoholism. But I'm not alcoholic because I did any of those things. I did some of those things because I'm alcoholic. And what I also know that in this room, if all of us took that test, different ones of us would answer yes or no to different questions. So there's not 100% litmus test for us, except the one that I found in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that fit me. And that is that when I honestly want to, I find I can't stop entirely. Or if when drinking, I have little control over the amount I take, I'm probably alcoholic. Now, when I saw that and when I could truly lay my life experience over that, I realized that both sides of that equation fit for me. I couldn't seem to stay stopped. And when I drank, I was unpredictable in how much I might drink. After that last DUI and after we had done the plea bargain in the courthouse that day, I was leaving the courthouse and they said, Steve, if you get arrested for any other drug or alcohol related offense during this year, you'll go directly to jail for a year. You'll be in violation of your probation and that's the way that'll go. And nothing frightened me more than the prospect of going to jail. I'm just not a tough guy. I just don't have the skill sets for jail. So I made a decision as I left the courthouse not to drink for the year of this probation, not for any other reason than to avoid the consequences of drinking for that year. And I was walking to my car, firmly convicted in this new decision that I had made. And sometimes I say I just parked too far from the courthouse because I began to think as I walked to my car, and I realized that this was an overcorrection to the problem. The real problem is that is drinking and driving, or driving and drinking. Whichever one I start first, I shouldn't do the other one, apparently. So I made a decision. I said, okay, I revised my plan, and the new plan was I won't drive when I drink. And I was firmly convicted to this new plan. And then I was not to my car yet, though, so as I walked a little further and thought a little more, I revised my plan one more time. And the new plan is I won't drink much when I drive. You know, it sounds funny again in here tonight, right? But see, that day it didn't feel crazy. It didn't feel rebellious. It didn't feel like anything but just linear thinking. And I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find in our book where it says that there'll come a time that a guy like me won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I couldn't make it from the courthouse steps to my car. The fear of going to jail was insufficient to keep me sober. The love of my wife and daughter was insufficient to keep me sober. The desire to keep a job or make a living or not disappoint those I love the most is insufficient to keep me sober. Those are strong motivators for me, but they're insufficient to keep me sober. What I find when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous is I have to surrender to my alcoholism, those things. And I love the surrender to win theme of the conference. But the surrender is not just to the problem. Then I've got to surrender to the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous offers me. Stuck with a problem without a solution is a tough place to be. A guy in my home group said one day, the first step is a wonderful place to get, but it's a terrible place to stay. And isn't that the truth? I was sitting next to a guy in a newcomers meeting one night, and I could tell this was 4 or 5 years ago, and he was looking kind of down, and I said, how's it going? And he said, Steve, I just surrendered today, and it really hurt. You know, and I thought, it just my experience, and I shared with him, I said, you know, it hurt me most just before the surrender. The surrender itself is where I began to find the relief. The surrender is when I quit fighting my alcoholism and began to embrace the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous offers. You know, at a point in that treatment facility, I decided I needed to stop drinking, and that was a real different decision than the decision that I wanted to stop drinking. They happened on two different occasions for me. I can't tell you the moment. Anyway, after that test, and after I was, I think I said yes to 10 of the questions. You know, I lied on several of the questions. I misunderstood several of the questions. So the only one I know I answered honestly and for certain is I never drank while pregnant. And not even once, and not even with a really good reason. Let me go back a little bit and tell you how what was going on with me before that June 30th. And I grew up in Smyrna, Tennessee, which is a small town about 30 miles out of Nashville. And I grew up in a middle-class family with no particular reason to be alcoholic, nothing major going on, you know. Mom and Daddy aren't knocking each other around. I got an older sister, an older brother, a younger sister. Just a middle-class life that was fairly uneventful from my vantage point. I'm sure there were things going on that I didn't see or know, but alcohol didn't seem to, in those early years, to play a particularly important role in my home. My mom and dad drank, but I didn't see it much, and I didn't think about it much. I used to say I was a pretty good kid, but I think more accurately is I was a pretty compliant kid. You know, I did what I said I was going to do. I was with who I said I was going to be with. I came home when I said I was going to come home. I didn't color outside the lines. You know, it didn't mean I didn't want to, but I was afraid to. I was afraid to draw unwanted negative attention to myself. So I had a real commitment to being average as I grew up. I was afraid to try things. You know, I look back so many things that I would have wanted to do, but wouldn't risk it because I was unwilling to look bad. I was unwilling to fail. I would much rather be Steve. That kid, man, that Steve is sharp if he would just apply himself. Man, that Steve, if he would just try, he's really got it going. And I would much rather be known with this potential as, man, that Steve, he really tries hard, but he just doesn't have it. And I was afraid if I really tried, if I really gave it my all, that I would still not have it and that I would expose myself. So I was unwilling. So what I know is I already had an exaggerated self-consciousness. I don't know if that was beyond what most other, you know, adolescents my age felt. I'm not sure how I differ from non-alcoholics at that time, at that age, but I know that's how I felt. I know that it's something that I couldn't quite articulate. I certainly didn't discuss it with other people. It was just always there under the surface. And I tried really hard not to let you know that that's how I felt. So I tried hard not to get caught feeling this way. When I was I decided not to drink for no big particular reason. I played sports and stuff like that in high school. But when I was a freshman in college, two buddies of mine came by to pick me up. We were going back to a high school basketball game, and I climbed into the back seat of a canary yellow 1968 Volkswagen Bug. And as we're headed to the ball game, they hand back a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine. You know, I appreciate the applause and the groans. I just have to say this, because I get groaned at a lot for that Boone's Farm. I know these first two drinks are pretty impressive, the first and the last one. But AA is the damnedest place I've ever been, you know, because we'll go to AA meeting and we'll brag about holding up 7-Elevens. And, oh, I got, you know, three different wives in three states, but I didn't drink Boone's Farm. And, you know, where we will plant our flag is a little strange to me. But But I began to, I'd had a sip of daddy's beer before, I'm sure, and a sip of the martini that my mother kept in the refrigerator for him, you know. But that's the first time I drank with purpose. As we began to pass that bottle around, I had that moment with alcohol that some people describe. And in my case, all of a sudden, I couldn't wait to get where we were going. Because I thought, for the first time, you couldn't wait to see me when I got there. You know? I mean, I'd never felt so, I'd found freedom from the bondage of self. I had that social lubricant again. I couldn't wait to spring myself on an unsuspecting world. We went out and I had a wonderful time that night to the best, but I blacked out, and I'm a blackout drinker, and I'm not a guy that blacks out for days at a time, but I lose periods of the night. I lose time. And Dave Attell, the comedian, I love his line a few years ago. He said that he was a blackout drinker, or as he liked to call it, time travel. And I identified, because how often did I just sort of suddenly look around and go, whoa, how did I get here in the future? And what has been going on? And some of you know what it's like to try to play detective and figure that out without asking questions or without asking straightforward questions. Just read the faces as they're coming towards you. And, you know, was I just kind of cute last night, or did I go way over the line? You know, did I? All of these things. And again, we laugh here, but the truth is that's an exhausting way to live for me. And actually, I spent a lot of time trying to figure those things out, drunk or sober. What do you think about me? How am I doing? How do you think I'm doing? You know, I was told by my sponsor one time, and he said, Steve, I don't know whether this is going to be the good news or bad news for you. He said, but you're not who you think you are. He says, and you're not who they think you are. And you're sure as hell not who you think they think you are. And you know what? I realized that I had given a disproportionate amount of time and energy to all three of those, trying to figure it out. Trying to find out how I stood by your measuring stick and what that turns me into. So when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find in our book where it says that the alcoholic, more than most, is an actor. That he wears two faces, and it's his stage character that he wants his fellows to see. He wants to be a man of certain reputation, but in his heart he knows he doesn't deserve it. See, I lived most of my life that way, and again, trying not to get caught. But what happens when I do that is I've got to be somebody different based on what I think, who I think you think I am, who I think you think I need to be, what I think will impress you or will win favor. Or at least not get me in the doghouse. How can I give you what I think you need to tell me I'm okay? It's an exhausting way to live. And when I drank, it was much easier to go about that charade. Now, I don't know if I was alcoholic just before I took that drink in the back of that Volkswagen. And I don't know if I was alcoholic right after I took it. And I don't know at what point I became alcoholic. I got some ideas, but here's why I don't know, see? I don't know if I drank alcoholically from that moment on, because I drank enthusiastically from that moment on. And what I believe is that lack of power is really not an issue until I try to exert some power. It's impossible to know if I had lack of power right after that first drink, because I did not try to stop. I did not try to moderate or control my drinking. I drank enthusiastically, aggressively, and at most opportunities. And even our book says that that while they have no way of proving it, they believe that many of them could have stopped drinking early in their drinking career. And I think for the same reason, the reason they don't know is because they didn't try it, right? So by the time I need to try to calibrate my drinking, lack of power, I wouldn't have called it this. I never thought for a moment, I didn't think in terms of lack of power. I never had three or four drinks, well, lack of power is kicking in now. I just didn't think that way. And sometimes I was going to not drink. It was never not going to drink forever, but I wasn't going to drink tonight, or I wasn't going to drink this week, or I wasn't, all those things that we've all done. And then it didn't seem like lack of power. It seemed like I changed my mind. Did you ever just change your mind? That's the only way. I didn't think in any. So I was so, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you articulated for me the problems and the experiences of my life in a way that I was unable to. I couldn't. Everything that I say about my alcoholism today, I say about it looking back at it from today's point of view. I wasn't, you know, sometimes when we talk from the podium, I think, and at least certainly I can speak for me, it may sound like I knew what was going on while it was happening. I didn't. Life was just happening to me. You know, life was just coming at me and I'm trying to figure it out. I'm also like the line in the 12 and 12 that says we're like actors in a play who've forgotten our lines. See, I feel like I'm in this world and you guys know your lines. You know your role. You know the part that you're supposed to play. And I don't know, but I am trying to improvise as best I can based on what's going on. And again, never, never get caught acting. So I'm living this fraudulent life. And even I don't barely know it. And trying not to get caught, trying to act like I got it together. You know, I began to drink, as I said, and I got consequences right away from my drinking. Ultimately, I totaled 6 cars and had a lot of just car accidents. You know, boom, there goes a bumper. I'm that guy that hits your car in the parking lot and drives off. I'm the, you know what I mean? I'm the guy that hits the mailbox down the street. My mother and I went to buy me a car one time, which will already, you know, the fact that my mother was going with me to buy a car tells you a lot about me. And, we are, the salesman is extolling the resale value of this Buick Regal we were looking at. And my mother says, don't bother. She said, we don't trade them in, we tow them in. And I'd been sober a few years before I ever traded a car in on another one. Usually we just, you know, you just drove it till it fell apart or was totaled. And I'm going to tell you 2 drinking stories and then sober up for the rest of the evening. But I ran off to Florida. I was working in the family business. I'm now out of school. Everybody said I was going to be good at this business. It was a sales business. And I was just terrible at it. You know, apparently you've got to make a sales call to sell anything. I stayed right by the phone and nobody called. But see, the truth is, I was scared to death. People were saying, Steve, you got a pretty good personality. You know, I mean, literally, because I was a fairly popular guy. I'm not a guy that was on the outside looking in. You know, I was a social guy, but I was so afraid of that you would discover how insecure I was and how afraid I was while I was right in the midst of this stuff. And people thought I was going to be pretty good at it, and I wasn't. I would go to these little towns at the time calling on furniture stores in rural Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. And I'd pull in a parking lot, and I couldn't go in. Sometimes I'd wait till the store manager came out. In these little towns, usually it was the owner typically, and I'd watch him leave to go to lunch, and then I would go in and ask for him. They said he's gone. I would leave my card telling him that I was by. And then I'd have to make calls in that evening to my brother, who was my boss. Our father had passed away at 47, and my brother started running our company, little sales company, at 22. When he was 26 and I was 22, I came to work there, and I was an immature 22. And I know today what a tough spot I put him in, but at the time I thought he treated me terribly unfairly. I'd had to call in the afternoons. Certainly there weren't cell phones and stuff, and lie about how I'd spent my day. And, you know, I went by and we're real close, and probably next time by we'll get this sale. And then I'd check in a little motor lodge and start drinking that night and smoking and staying up real late at night. I would stay up real late because when the rest of the world was asleep was when I began to feel comfortable. And I knew that during the day, I felt always like I'm the guy that's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, because I wasn't. And I thought everybody knew it. It looked like that I was wearing a sign that said this. That's the way it felt. So I kind of ran away to Florida. These guys who had been unfamiliar with my drinking history gave me a job and a company car. Much like Beverly did the other day. I was over at some friend's house watching Monday Night Football. We were drinking heavily and accessorizing that with a variety of other things. I left at halftime. I jumped in my car. I sped down this residential street. I could not navigate what I used to refer to as a hairpin turn. I believe there was just about a 10-degree angle. I drove through. I hit this tree. I hit this tree really hard. It caved in the whole passenger side of the car, broke out the front windshield, the back windshield, knocked in the hood of the car.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And it shook me up, but it didn't hurt me badly. And I knew enough, if I stay here, the police are going to come. I'm going to get another DUI. I'm going to lose this job. You got to deal with everything that comes with this type of deal. So I put the car in reverse, and it backed away. I said, I'm going to drive it, try to get it back over to my buddy's house and come up with a plan. I know I'm in a room full of folks that know a little something about putting a plan together. Driving over there, the car's shaking. It's driving almost sideways. The frame is bent so badly, and people are staring at me, and I just said, God, let me get over there. And I finally got there, and I went inside, and Larry, Curly, and Mo put a plan together. The plan was they'd get back in the car with me. We would drive it back over there and drive it back into the tree. Not hard, you know, we'd just ease it into the tree, then we would call the police, and the police would come, and these guys would serve as witnesses to corroborate my story that I had been run off the road, you know, probably by a drunken driver. We eased the car back up against the tree. I got out to walk up to the house at the corner to borrow the phone at that home, and this guy comes flying out the side door of his house, and he is running down where we are, and he had a grave concern on his face, and he said, are you guys okay? Are you all right? And I said, yeah, man, we're okay. And he said, well, it's the damnedest thing. He said, you're the second guy to hit that tree tonight. I said, yeah, man, you ought to cut that damn tree down. It is poorly placed. A year later, I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was at a TGI Fridays off of Roswell Road in Sandy Springs, and throwing back kamikaze shooters and taking two and alls. And I got on the interstate coming out of there, 285, around Atlanta, going east in the westbound lane, and I hit a car head-on, and two other cars hit us, and it totaled all four cars, and I came to in the Fulton County Jail the next morning. I had urinated on myself, and I had vomited on myself, or at least I say I hope I did, because somebody did. But the fact is, that morning, never, never had I been more afraid of the consequences that awaited me. Legal, personal, professional. Never had I been more ashamed of what I'd done and the harm I'd caused other people. And I didn't yet know the extent of the possible injuries. And as it turns out, no one was badly injured. I did get sued over that. I mean, there were some people sent to the hospital, but thank God no one was fatally hurt. And never had I been more humiliated at the state I found myself in, my own urine and my own vomit. And never had I been more certain that I would never drink again. And 10 days later, I'm driving down the road, smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, thinking I nearly overreacted to that. And that's the alcoholism that I have. And I think that's again, where I couldn't bring the consciousness with sufficient force. That's how powerful the alcoholism that I have was affecting me at that time. People would ask that question, Steve, why would you do that again? Why would you get back in the car? Why would you drink and drive? You know those questions that those that love us and care about us would ask. And there's no answer for that question. There's no answer for me until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I didn't know that I had this mental obsession. I didn't know I had this physical allergy. When the doctor's opinion says that when he writes in there, and we respond that the doctor's opinion, the doctor's theory that we had an allergy interested us, for it explains that for which there's no other explanation. That interested me. When I saw that in our book, that's why I love the book Alcoholics Anonymous so much, because finally I'm hearing from you and I'm reading in this book And I can lay my life experience over what you're sharing with me. That identification, one alcoholic with another, which is the at the core of Alcoholics Anonymous. That language of the heart, that is the core of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the second day, third day maybe that I was in that treatment facility, two men from AA came by, and that was, to my knowledge, the first two men that I'd ever met from AA. They came in and explained that we were going to have an AA meeting. They said that we're not affiliated with this facility. And it felt like that all day long in that treatment facility, that I'd been charged with the crime of alcoholism. And that all day long that they were trying to convict me of the charges. They were asking me questions about my drinking. They were using my answers to talk to me. They were saying, "See, Steve, don't you get it? Can't you see? Isn't this clear?" They were very logically pointing out to me that I was alcoholic and that I had this problem with alcohol. And I was doing the best I could to rebut the case, to provide explanations. And then these two men came in, and they did, I know looking back, exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous suggests we do. They came in as ex-problem drinkers in whom the problem had been solved, properly armed with the facts about themselves. They didn't ask me a thing about my drinking. What they did was they said, "Guys, sit back, relax. We're not here to try to convince anybody that they're alcoholic. We're not here on a membership drive from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. We don't get a commission on you." They explained that they were there because it was important to their sobriety, and that they were there to offer a message of hope and recovery to anyone who might be interested, and they weren't interested in forcing it on anyone who wasn't. So I could relax. I could sit back and I could just listen. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I had the I used to say nothing big happened that night, but I believe something really big happened that night, but it was almost imperceptible to me. I was able to relax, and when they left, the feeling I had was I felt better for them having been there, that I hoped they'd come back. I don't remember the information specifically that they may have shared. You know, I didn't go, "Let go and let God, I'm in, boys." I didn't take the AA altar call that night, you know. I just hoped they'd come back, and they did, by the way. And I'll tell you something, that yesterday, on my 22nd birthday, one of those men has passed away, and the other one lives there in Franklin, Tennessee, a neighboring community. And I called him yesterday and thanked him, as I do every June the 30th. Thank him for coming by, and it always reminds me, I got to ask myself, am I willing to be that guy for somebody else? Am I willing to show up now when it's inconvenient or uncomfortable? And sometimes I am, and sometimes, you know, I don't do as good as I'd like. But every June 30th, I certainly think about it because those two men came and shared a message of hope with me. It was about 3 weeks into that that treatment experience that I decided we were going out to AA meetings and other 12-step meetings. And I'm very grateful that we were welcomed in to a whole variety of 12-step meetings, that people opened their door and their coffee pot to us. And, you know, we made noise. We got up when we shouldn't have. We talked during the meeting. I'm sure that I know that because I know sometimes when the van pulls up today how that works at my group. And I got to remember that these guys don't get off the van knowing the drill. And not everybody gets off the van wanting to be there. But I'll tell you, I'm one of those guys that didn't want to be there. I'm one of those guys that caught alcoholism when I understood more about alcoholism, when you explained a problem to me that I couldn't articulate, when I finally heard you. So I try to be more tolerant to those folks that show up, even if they don't know how to play the game yet. And then talk to folks later and try to help them understand. I decided that I needed to stop drinking, as I told you. And I made a commitment that's what I was going to do. But here's what I thought. I thought a life in Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be all about where I can't go, what I can't do, and who I can't hang out with. I thought my life was about to get really small. In fact, I thought not drinking was an actual activity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought most of my time was going to be spent not drinking. And when the boys would call, say, "Hey, Steve, we're going to play golf next weekend. Would you like to go?" "I'd love to go, boys, but I'll be home not drinking." "Sunday, we're going to go to the football game. Let's, you know, man, we've got a bunch of us going." "No, boys, I'll be home not drinking all day Sunday. I'll just be home not drinking." And I was prepared to do that. That's what I thought it was. And I thought we'd, you know, meet at the, get to these meetings once or twice a day and talk each other out of a drink. And we'd just hold on and grip tight. And it would be a life of self-sacrifice. Right? You guys know nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. When we say in Vision for You that if I'm going to give up this drinking, do you have a substitute? Does AA have a substitute? And the book says, in my experience, that it is vastly more than that. See, it's amazing that a guy like me, even there, even under those conditions, given everything that alcohol had done to me, and that's one of the things that I think that happened. See, when I got to that treatment facility, I didn't want to stop drinking. I wanted to drink just enough. You know, I just want to drink just enough. I want to get just drunk enough. I never wanted to drink enough not to get drunk. I want to get drunk. When our book says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, I would tell you in my case that that must mean that I drink because I don't like the effect produced by sobriety. I need to drink enough to feel differently than before I started drinking. But I didn't want to get too drunk. See, I want to drink just enough to get everything alcohol does for me without suffering the pains of what alcohol had begun to do to me. I want to drink and get what it says that most normal folks get in A Vision for You. Conviviality. Release from care, boredom, and worry. Joyous intimacy with friends. Colorful imagination and a feeling that life is good. Yeah, I got a little thirsty just saying it. That's an attractive package to me. But see, that's not what I get. That's not what was happening to me. And it says that in the latter days of our drinking, that's not what a guy like me gets. Maybe momentarily, which I discovered was maybe between about 8 and 10:30 for me. Then comes oblivion and awakening to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. So that's what I felt in that jail cell in Fulton County that morning. Again, man, I keep doing this again and again. So when I stop drinking, have you got something for me? Boy, you have had. It's vastly more than that. And it's the same thing that's in that attractive package. It says what you have for me is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the same as joyous intimacy with friends. It says I get released from care, boredom, and worry, which is the exact same thing that most normal folks get from a few drinks. It says that I'll have colorful imagination, or my imagination will be fired, which is the same as colorful imagination. And it says the most satisfactory years of our existence lie ahead. So we find the fellowship, and so will you. And then that has been my experience. Life will mean something at last. You know, I think that's been... We were having dinner and talking about our daughter tonight with Beverly and Chris. And I was saying that my daughter and I, we were driving down to... I'm going to veer off here for a minute. But Connie and I, we were at dinner in December of this past year. Our daughter was born on December the 17th, 1983. I was drunk when she was born. I was at the hospital, but I was drunk. I made up a story for years. You know how people get together and they tell the story about when their kids were born, and I had a story that I told. And it may have been partially true because it was just a fuzzy memory, and I told it so often that it became true to me. And I was probably sober about 10 years before I mentioned to Connie that, you know, and of course she was out, but that was... what happened. And she reminded me at that dinner almost 22 years later, right? Longer than that, but 22 years into our sobriety and almost 27 years since that birth, that I went to the hospital over the next few days for about 15 or 20 minutes a day. And I was going home and I had a mattress on the floor pulled up in this little duplex we lived in. And I couldn't face life. I couldn't get up and be a dad, and I couldn't be a husband, and I couldn't face what was in front of me. I didn't know how to do this. And I barely went by to see him. About 3 years ago, my daughter and I were driving downtown to listen to a friend play some music, and I was relaying the story to her that my brother had, we were just having a conversation, but he'd said something to the effect that, you know, I don't think you really need to go to as many meetings as you do to have this activity that you do in AA to stay sober. I don't think everything you do is necessary for you to stay sober. And I was just explaining, you know, having that conversation with my daughter, and she said, well, you know, Dad, she said, you and Mom do more than just stay sober, you help people. Now, we know what that level of help is that we just share with each other. But what I wanted you to know is that I got a daughter who thinks that her mom and dad are living useful, purposeful lives, that our lives mean something. And that's a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I popped out of that treatment facility and I'd made this decision to stay sober, but I didn't know what staying sober was going to look like. I didn't know what it was going to mean. I'd seen these 12 steps, but I didn't know anything about actually taking them. They read well. I went down, I fell in with some folks at the 202 Club there in Nashville, and my first sponsor, Frank D. And Frank was referred to as a big book thumper, and it was not a term of endearment around there to those folks. And there was a group of folks in a book study, but I will tell you that they did not thump me with that book, but what they did was help me find the message of recovery that's contained in the book, where the integrity of the message is protected. And Frank said, Steve, hang out here a little bit. He said, do what we're doing and go to those open discussion meetings if you want to, but make sure that you learn enough about this program that when you're in them, you know if what you're hearing is Alcoholics Anonymous and you know if what you're sharing is Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I tried to do for that first year. I'll be forever grateful for the foundation in AA that I got through those folks and through that sponsor, Frank. I was 6 months sober before I realized, I don't know about some of you folks and some of you new people that may be here. Again, it was at about 6 months before I realized that some of you people were talking to each other between meetings. You know what I mean? I thought you showed up and went home right away and you come back, you know, but I didn't know. People were building relationships. There was a fellowship that was going on. And I wanted to be a part of it, but again, I was self-conscious. I didn't want to face that awkward moment. So people began announcing at the end of the meeting, particularly on the Saturday meeting I went to, they said, we're going to lunch after the meeting, you know, anybody wants to come, come on. I desperately wanted to go. And I would get in the car and I would be going to go and then I would veer off and head home. And the reason was, as I was afraid I would get to the restaurant, there would be six people at a table for six. And I didn't know whether to pull up the seventh chair. I didn't know whether they really meant me. I wasn't willing to have that awkward moment. I wasn't willing to face the embarrassment. You know, what I really needed was three or four people to come up to me after the meeting and go, Steve, we've been talking and we really want you to go to lunch with us. And we're just arguing over who gets to sit with you. And then I would have been comfortable enough to go. But that uncertainty, see, that insecurity, that self-consciousness. At a year sober, I moved to Richmond, Virginia, and fell in with a guy over there named Joe, who became my sponsor. And Joe shared some things with me over time, and I'll share a few of those perspectives and then start to close this thing up. Joe was very service-oriented, and he got me into service, and I got to serve a lot of different service positions. I was terribly inept. I was the most inept DCM in the history of District 29 in Richmond, Virginia, but I did my 2 years. Because when Joe suggested I go stand for that, I said, Joe, that's a two-year commitment, and I'm not a two-year guy. And he said, I know, Steve. He said, that's why I want you to go. He says, can you commit to something? Are you grateful to be sober? Can you serve this fellowship in the way that it served you? He says, I'm not asking you to be good at it. He said, believe me, the guy that's got the position now is not good at it. But are you willing to show up and see what happens? I shared with Joe that I was very bothered by the phrase and how it works when it talked about some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas. And the result was nil till we let go absolutely. And as I'm reading that, it implied that I never, you know, that every idea I had before I got to AA was a bad idea. You know, and I said, Joe, I showed up here with some damn good ideas, man. And he said, Steve, I'm sure you did, buddy. He said, I've not heard any of them yet, but I suspect you did. Yeah. But he said, that's not what it means. At least it's not what it meant to him. And I've embraced his point of view. He says, what AA is asking you to do, he says, Steve, don't be limited by the ideas you showed up with. He says, it's not saying that they're all bad ideas. It's not saying that they're without value. It's not saying that you can't pick them back up when the time's appropriate. He says, but are you willing to be open-minded enough to set everything down so that you might embrace some new ideas? Are you willing to start with a blank canvas and see what finds its way back to you as you go through this process? Can you surrender to win? Can you let go? Absolutely. And I've tried to do that with varying degrees of success from time to time. I'd spoken at great length at a meeting one night, almost as long as I've talked tonight, you know, and it wasn't a speaker meeting. And I got home, and Joe had been in the meeting, and I called him, and I said, Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting tonight? And he said, oh, Steve, he said, you're still asking all the wrong questions. He says, because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous? And he said, see, you don't care if you were self-righteous or not. You're afraid they caught you. You're afraid that somebody's driving home in their car going, boy, that's Steve. He's a self-righteous son of a gun. See, he was right. He was right. I was caught up again in what you thought. He says, if you weren't self-righteous, don't worry about it. If you were, try not to do it next time. Now go on about your business. My brother and I bought, and I was going to say we bought an office building because that sounds impressive, but we bought a building in which we put two desks. And we were buying some furniture to furnish this little office that we got, and we thought this would be a good time to buy some furniture for our homes and bill it through the business and get the tax advantages that go with this type of transaction. And I wasn't even conflicted by it. I was talking to Joe. I wasn't even asking for permission. I'm just kind of letting him know what's going on. He said, Steve, I don't think I would do that. And that's kind of the way he operated. He never told me what to do, but he said, I don't think I'd be comfortable doing that. And I said, well, Joe, I know it sounds a little bit like tax fraud. And he went, no, Steve, it actually is tax fraud. See, that's the difference, right? I'm the kind of guy that can think, it's kind of a first cousin to tax fraud. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you helped me begin to see the truth. He said, Steve, he says, I don't care whether you do it or not. He said, but don't kid yourself about what you're doing. So you peel away the fuzzy view of life that I give myself. You help me see the truth and make the choices I make based on that truth and then be accountable for those choices, whatever they might be. I didn't do it that time, but I don't have time to tell you my whole story tonight. You've taught me things here. That's probably not the appropriate word because I'm not sure that I've learned anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, certainly I have. I've become aware of information I didn't know before I got here. But the real deal is that through the application of these principles in my daily living, my life changes and I see things differently than I saw them before, right? I have that new pair of glasses from time to time. And I think over time that the prescription maybe keeps getting dialed in a little bit more and I can see things clearer or differently or in a different light than I did before. I have come to know here, though I can't always make practical application of it, that my problems aren't what I think they are. See, I will tell you what my problems are. I will lay out the conditional problems. It might be a financial problem. It might be Connie and I having a problem. It might be my daughter. I will talk about my problem, but no matter what problem I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous, you offer me one solution. It's a spiritual solution, and it's not to solve the external problem. It's to help me live with whatever's going on in my life. See, my problem's not my problem. My problem is that my problem is a problem. My problem is I've decided it's a problem. I have learned here that it is okay for more and more things to happen to me. See, it is, if I've got this list of things that can't be happening to me and they are happening to me, then I am destined to be uncomfortable. Our book says that a life of unmet demands is going to leave me in a continual state of disturbance. I realized after I was here in AA for a good while that I spent most of my life waiting to have a good day. Have you, I mean, you ever just wait? You know, in 1997, I got so close I could see it. You know, and then somebody moved, right? I mean, and we talk a lot about a day at a time, but today's the day. Today's the day under this set of circumstances, as I am, as you are, whatever it is. If I want to have a good day, this is the only day I can have it. Now, knowing that doesn't always make it happen for me, but it gives me that perfect ideal to aim for. I was about 60 days sober, and I was sitting in a meeting, and the guy was... new guy was in there. When you're 60 days sober, there's nothing you like better than a brand new guy in the meeting, right? Because they'll start talking to him instead of you for it. In fact, I took a shot at him. But everybody's giving their little pitch, you know. And this particular day, everybody, you know, said some very encouraging words to the guy and said, keep coming back, it gets better. Next person, keep coming back, it gets better. And finally, this old guy named Herb that was in there, and he said, I tell you, when it gets better when it's okay the way that it is. And that's what I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that don't make me wait. How can I be okay today under this set of circumstances? Take the last couple of minutes doing what I believe our book also suggests I do. It says that each of us, in his own language and from his own point of view, talks about how he established a relationship with God, with a higher power. And I showed up here, we were talking about it at dinner a little bit tonight, but I showed up at AA with no real relationship. And I don't think I was agnostic or atheist, but I was at a minimum apathetic. You know, I was uninterested, uninvolved, uninvested in anything about that. But I was also uncomfortable with the language of spirituality, of God, of prayer, of spiritual awakening, spiritual experiences. All of that bothered me. I spent a lot of time telling people what I didn't believe about God. You'd say something, I'd tell you what I didn't believe about that and why. And finally, a guy shared with me one night, he said, Steve, he said, we don't care what you don't believe. And really what he meant was, is that I was free not to believe anything I didn't want to believe in AA. There's nothing to fight about. He said, but decide what you do believe and act like a guy would act if he believed it. And that's when I realized what I didn't have was anything that I did believe. I had no anchorage to any set of permanent values. I was free-floating in the wind. I didn't know who I was, and I certainly didn't know anything about this relationship with a higher power. When we would get up and say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting, as we often do in my part of the country, I wouldn't hold hands and I wouldn't say the prayer. I would back away. Guy asked me one night, he said, Steve, what's that all about, man? And I couldn't have been more earnest when I said, you know, I don't know what I believe. I'm not going to just hold hands and sing kumbaya with the rest of the lemmings here, you know. I don't want to be a hypocrite. And he kind of laughed at me, and he said, he had heard my first fifth step, and he says, I'm real glad to see where you draw the line at hypocrisy, Steve, given everything else you've done. He said, I've got good news and bad news for you, you know. And I was felt a little condescended to, but I said, I'll play. What's the bad news? He said, the bad news is hypocrisy is way down your list of problems. And you might ought to address them in the order in which they will kill your ass. And I said, what's the good news? And he said, the good news is there is room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, that's as good a news for me tonight as it was then, I promise you. It gave me a little freedom to move along and do some things that I'd been unwilling to do, and act like a guy would act if he believed that there was a higher power. Take some of the actions a guy would take if he believed it. I don't call that fake it till you make it. I call it act as if, because I would tell anybody who would listen that I didn't believe it, but I'm going to do what a guy would do if he did. Then at about 8 years sober, I found what continues to work for me today. It's just a point of view for me, but it's in We Agnostics. It says that no one can fully define or comprehend that power which is God. That means no one, right? So that means we're all free to have a point of view, and I can't challenge yours, and you can't challenge mine, and it's unimportant. It says that deep down within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. In fact, in the last analysis, it is only there that the great reality may be found. So I've decided that's where God's hanging out, in me and in you. And that has become the connection point that I have with the human race that I felt a little disaffected from before. Just a point of view that I've taken. So that has become the common denominator. Then it says, all right, Steve, look out. He says that this newfound relationship may be obscured by pomp, by worship of other things, and by calamity. Pomp seems to be the reemergence of pride, of ego, itself, and that certainly flares up. Worship of other things seems to be any of those things which I place above that relationship with my sobriety, with AA, and with that higher power. And calamity can be, Connie and I went bankrupt at 10 years sober, as she is prone to say, I went bankrupt and took her with me. So it can be financial ruin. It can be the death of a loved one. It can be those things, or I can get home on Sunday or Monday rather, and some of the TV shows that I DVR'd while we were gone might not have recorded. And the reason I will tell you that's a calamity is because I've decided that a calamity is anything I've decided can't be happening to me. And in AA, I'm more and more willing for more and more things to happen to me. That makes life get easier when more and more is okay. And then it says, as I draw near to him, he will disclose himself to me. So truly the way I draw near to him is to draw near to you. So you invite me here this weekend and you give me a few minutes, not that you need to hear what I have to say, but I got an overwhelming need to say it. You give me some time to spend in your company. You let me share my life with you. You'll share your life with me over the weekend. And then in closing, there was a man named Mo H. there in Nashville, and Mo shared the verse to a poem whenever he shared his story. And in the few lines in that poem, he described more eloquently than I've been able to this evening my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Mo loved alcoholics more than anybody had ever known. You know, some of us love AA. So let's get to AA and love AA, and then we don't want alcoholics messing it up. You know, I become intolerant of the alcoholic, you know. Why don't you go sober up and then come on back to our meeting and when you can act right. He loved alcoholics, drunk or sober, more than anyone I ever knew. And when he was just 6 weeks from passing away of cancer in October of 2003, my friend Jerry and I went and had breakfast with Mo, and I asked Mo if he would mind if, when I got an opportunity to share my story, that I closed with the verse to that poem as he did, because it would help me remember him, but more importantly, it would allow me to pass on in the truest sense of AA what he had passed on to me and so many others. And it simply said, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. I sought my fellow man and found all three. See, and that's how I found the God of my understanding here, through you sharing your life with me and allowing me to share mine with you just a little bit as you have this evening. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.